Chapter 1. It was late summer, and at that time the war had not yet come so close to home. Oh, they were anticipating war. Everyone knew about Bunker Hill. They knew about Lexington and Concord. They knew about the great hero Washington forcing the Redcoats out of Boston. They knew the British had their eyes on the nearby port of New York and had landed troops on Staten Island. There was chatter at the general store about the king's heavily armed warships that choked New York Harbor, and the two that had sailed up the Hudson and docked at Tarrytown before heading to North Point, causing rejoicing among the much beleaguered Tories who believed deliverance was at hand and striking terror into everyone else. News had come very recently about the Declaration of Independence, which was read publicly, openly throughout the colonies, and for the first time in White Plains, their hometown, from the steps of the courthouse. Yes, war seemed inevitable, in the sense that such a thing could even be imagined by people accustomed to peace in their quiet country town. But as of yet, there was no war. There were dreamy summer days like any other summer. There were lovers' walks in the meadows with the sun shining and the hazy blue skies of August. There were the birds of summer, the white-tailed hawks and mockingbirds and scarlet tanagers, which incidentally reminded everyone of the Redcoats. The Redcoats themselves, however, still seemed more like a story in press and pamphlets than something that was soon to become part of their everyday lives. "Your face is red, little Rachel. I take it your fair skin is not used to the sun," Charles Taylor teased his attractive young visitor. "My skin has had its fair share of the sun in the garden," she replied, "but it may be the exertion of walking." Rachel had her father's sense of humor without her mother's shrewish tongue. She was not afraid to respond to Mr. Taylor when he teased her, because she sensed he liked it. "No doubt you were in a great hurry to get here," he said, "but your father might have spared you a horse. I hope he was not afraid of me impounding it as a sort of tax on his stable." "I would never think of asking for a horse during haying season," Rachel replied. "And besides, I love to walk at this time of year. I love the tiger lilies and Queen Anne's lace, soon to be gone." "Queen Anne," he said, "I should think you would want to avoid her at all costs, being a good patriot girl." "They memorialize the grandmother, I believe," Rachel said. "Therefore, I feel safe in admiring them." "Ah, you are a clever girl," he replied. "Still, no daughter of mine would walk 3 miles in the hot summer sun for the sake of her complexion. My sons, however, can be as ruddy as they like. I do not approve of these modern dandies who fancy themselves gentlemen and never do an honest day's work outdoors. Do you?" "Not at all," she said. "An honest man is not afraid to come into the sun." Rachel was there to see Mr. Taylor's older son, the one tacitly alluded to when he accused her of rushing. It had not been her intention to come into the house, but Mrs. Taylor insisted on it and gave her some cool tea in her own favorite pewter cup. She stood demurely by the window while she waited for John to appear. Mr. Taylor was a Tory, but he was an intelligent man and better educated than anyone else she knew in her small town, having gone to the great university at Edinburgh. She was not afraid to spar respectfully with him, just as her mother did with men who ventured into her lair. She was also happy to bear some good-natured abuse, since he was John's father. John came in a moment later with his sister Elsie, who had been sent by their mother to fetch him from the barn, where he and their brother Edwin had been engaged in the endless task of sawing and splitting firewood for the long winter. "Ah, here he comes," Mr. Taylor said. "It seems you have a visitor, young man." "So I do," John replied in as few words as possible, feeling abashed in Rachel's presence with prying eyes upon them. "Do you want to go outside?" he said to her, and then became even more flustered as his words echoed around the room. "Are you sure you wouldn't rather stay here and chat?" his father teased. "Let them go," his wife said. "The young people need to talk." So off they went. Charles watched them with a broad smile as they approached the barn and eventually disappeared from view. But then the distortion of the hand-blown glass gave him a queasy feeling, and a wave of melancholy swept over him. For all his bluff cheerfulness, his heart was full of apprehension about the future. He and Ruth had purchased their brick farmhouse and 200 acres 30 years earlier, for a price that would have seemed unimaginable in their native Scotland. Opportunity and land were scarce at home, nor did Charles care for the politics that were current at the time, with foreigners on the throne in the aftermath of Culloden. He was able to talk Ruth into making the great change not long after they were married, in spite of her deep attachment to home, for the prospect of freedom and prosperity. They worked hard and were happy for many years. The land in the Hudson Valley was much richer than anything they had known in Scotland, and the wheat crops did quite well. Lately, however, he had begun to wonder if the move had been a mistake. First came the long bloody war with the French and their dreaded Indian allies, which did not touch White Plains directly but was a source of anxiety in all of the colonies, since it was not clear which of the great powers would prevail. Then came the taxation firestorm as a result of those wars and a growing division between the firebrand patriots, who were holding forth with increasing boldness about liberty and self-government, and the conservative so-called loyalists, who felt an attachment to the crown and old ties. Charles Taylor was a loyalist by nature and reason as well as by birth. He knew England had her faults, he was a Scot, after all, but he was not ready to abandon her ancient, benevolent, and orderly patronage, as he saw it, for uncertain government by a ragtag collection of colonial hotheads. Charles did not particularly like Grenville's stamp tax, or the Townshend Act, or the Tea Act, being a great lover of tea himself, but he could not be blind to the reasonableness of the argument. It did not seem strange to him that the colony should contribute to their own defense, regardless of whether they had representation in Parliament. Unlike native-born colonists, he was used to paying taxes to the crown and did not share their childish pique, as he saw it, at being asked to do so themselves. As for the so-called intolerable acts, that was just another incendiary label from the mayhem mongers. To his way of thinking, those acts were nothing more than an attempt to restore order out of chaos. But order was not restored. On the contrary, things became much worse. Some of the colonies formed their own provincial legislatures. Tories were banned from having any role, which in Charles' view meant these legislatures were not representative at all, and showed the radicals to be just as autocratic as the autocrats they despised. The final outrage to Tory sensibilities, however, was the Declaration of Independence. The patriots applauded its bold and colorful language, but the feelings of the loyalists on this subject were less cordial, since this very boldness seemed to sever them from the source of their identity as Englishmen, and, in the view of many, would lead to economic ruin. No longer were the leading politicians resisting specific excesses of royal rule. Now they wanted to throw off the yoke entirely and form their own more perfect union, as they called it. This was a momentous change and, from the loyalist point of view, fraught with peril. Charles did not like change. He had a tendency to cling to what was fond and familiar. English life and English customs were solid and respectable. Moreover, they were his customs. The thought of throwing them away filled him with dismay. Also, he had a natural abhorrence for loud-mouthed rabble-rousers like Patrick Henry and Charles Adams, who seemed willing to tear down everything good but had nothing sensible to offer in its place. He read their pamphlets. He saw through their rhetoric, their lies and omissions, their devices. He saw how they manipulated the truth. All his friends did. Why didn't everyone? To him, the situation seemed patently unfair. It was not the Tories who were stirring up trouble in the colonies. They were content to live in peace and prosper. No, it was evil spawn like the Sons of Liberty. They were the ones who were the avowed enemies of the status quo, who declared themselves to be on a holy crusade and seemed to have no qualms about violence. No loyalist was safe where they spread their poison. There had been vicious attacks for over a decade in Boston and even some in New York, in spite of its sizable loyalist population, including the recent riots in Manhattan. Charles lived in perpetual anxiety about his own beloved family and what might happen to them if the radicals actually succeeded. And now there was the prospect of war. The colonial hotheads had started a fight they could not possibly win and dragged everyone else into it with them, including those who had no desire to break with their homeland. Charles was not for war. What he wanted was to be left alone and work his farm in peace. But this no longer seemed possible. He had every confidence in England's splendid army and navy, having seen them up close as a young man. There was no question in his mind that they would crush the shabby Continentals. But at what cost to him and his family? Would the hotheads be content with hot words when it came to, quote, loyalists? Or would they attempt something worse? Ruth came to him with a mug of beer as a peace offering for her rebuke.
She was a thin woman whose handsomeness had faded with childbearing and the hard work of making her way in a new land without the community support of family or friends. She had a mild disposition in spite of a somewhat severe appearance and a passionate love for her husband and family. "You and Rachel seem to be enjoying yourselves," she said. "She is a remarkable girl," he replied. "It is rare to see such intelligence and self-possession in someone so young, and she has even read some books, unlike our own dawdling offspring. I don't see how she can have such a father, but the girl herself is remarkable." "She cannot help her father," Ruth said. "She seems a very respectful, kind young lady to me." "Aye, that she is," Charles replied, "and I enjoy talking to her." "You seem to enjoy teasing her," she said, "and you do not tease people unless you like them." He patted her hand. "Now, now, I understand you. She is a good-humored girl. To tell the truth, I almost cannot help teasing her. But I wish she did not have such a father, a stubborn man by all accounts who will not listen to reason. And her mother, that harridan terrorizes the whole town. How could God make such a woman with a serpent for a tongue?" "But you will be kind to her in spite of all that," Ruth said. "For your son's sake, I believe he is very much in love." "Bah," Charles said. "What do these young bucks know about love? 5 minutes of rhapsody followed by 50 years of servitude. But I knew where you were angling. I'm an angler myself. You want to see them together. I have no objection to it for its own sake. But I do wish the girl did not have such a father." "You would not oppose them, I hope," his wife said. "I have no desire to oppose them, but you must acknowledge the times," he replied. "War is in the air, and there is likely to be a good deal of bloodshed and conflict between those who are determined to have their own country and people like me who prefer to honor our obligations. The line has been drawn because of outspoken patriots like her father. He makes himself my enemy. What am I to do?" "But think of your son and his happiness," she replied. "You see what he is like when he's with her." "Come, come," he said. "I already said I have nothing against the girl. But I am in no position to be making promises. Passion is the master of the times. We do not know where we will be in 5 years. How can we talk about weddings?" This conversation was vexing to Ruth. She loved her husband, but was afraid of his temper, afraid that his strong opinions would put their family in jeopardy. She herself did not have strong feelings about the present troubles. She felt the same tug as her husband to the land of her birth, but it was in her nature to make her nest wherever she was. Were the colonies to remain colonies, or were they to be free? It did not matter much to her. All she cared about was the well-being of the people she loved. And something else, she very much wanted John to marry Rachel Allen. They were perfect for each other. John was a shy, kind young man who needed someone to draw him out. Rachel was outgoing, and she could see that she loved him. She wanted happiness for both of her sons, especially for John. But the future seemed like a blur to her now. Chapter 2. Meanwhile, John and Rachel were walking through the meadow toward the brook. John loved the tall rye on hot summer days and the soft heads of the second growth on his outstretched palms. He could think of nothing to say to this girl he doted on, but his own quietness embarrassed him, and therefore he was longing for her to say something. "I do not think your father likes me," was the unexpected something that she finally said. "What makes you say that?" he said. "He always seems to scowl at me," she replied. "That is not his real scowl, believe me," John assured her. "You would know if he were scowling at you. He probably doesn't know what to make of you, being a patriot's daughter. And your mother has a certain reputation in Tory circles, as you may be aware. But if he takes an active dislike to someone, they definitely know it. He's not very good at hiding his feelings." "But how does he feel about us?" Rachel said. "What are the two of them saying about us right now when they know we cannot hear them?" "Well, he probably would not be happy if he saw us trampling down his hay," John replied. "But I don't think he has any objection to us being together." "You don't think?" she said. "I don't know for certain, because he's never said anything to me about it. He's never said anything negative, if that's what you're worried about. And of course my mother thinks the world of you." "Come on, really?" she said. "Oh yes," he replied. "Can't you tell? Just the other day she was going on and on about what a nice girl you are. She doesn't do things like that normally." "Nice," she said. "Maybe she thinks I'm minced." "No," John said. "She means kind, obviously. I've also heard her say you were one of the brightest young women she knows, even in the presence of my sisters. But that makes me wonder what you see in me." "I would tell you, but then your head would swell, and I would get no straight answers out of you at all," she replied. "But do you think she would consent to us marrying in spite of my nefarious family?" "I didn't call them that," he said. "I simply said your mother has a certain reputation, which is a matter of fact. But yes, my mother will give her consent. I don't have the slightest doubt of it." "And your father," she said, "he can't stand patriots." "All I know is he seems to like you. Also, don't underestimate my mother's power of persuasion. She doesn't ask for much, but he almost always gives in when she does, after a little struggle." "In my family, it's just the opposite," Rachel said. "My mother has a great deal to say, and none of it has any influence at all." "Ah, yes," he said, "that is where the greater obstacle lies, in my opinion. You are worried about what my parents will say, but what about your mother? She hates Tories at least as much as my father hates patriots. Could she accept someone like me?" "How could she not?" Rachel said, "handsome and intelligent as you are." "Oh, thanks," he said. "Won't she be afraid of what her friends will say?" "Not at all," Rachel replied. "She takes positive delight in doing things her friends disapprove of. But if you really are so worried about it, I will ask her myself. I, at least, am not afraid to speak out." "Don't be ridiculous," he said. "You're just as afraid as I am. You would only do it to show me up." "That may be true," she said, laughing. "Oh, I wish there were some way for us to get married without all this rigmarole." "Are we getting married?" he said. "I don't know," she said. "I haven't been asked." John had not asked because it seemed to be assumed. They knew they were in love with each other and knew they were going to get married without ever having to talk about it. He was not in the position of those poor suitors who must expose themselves to mortification by asking for the hand of the beloved without having any idea of whether they will be accepted. And suddenly he wanted to propose. Maybe it was the late summer haze. Maybe it was the fatigue from chopping wood. Maybe it was the madness of the times. In any case, he bent down in the middle of the hayfield, his head bobbing on a sea of rippling grass, his knee on an inconvenient pebble, and took her right hand tenderly in his. "Rachel Allen, would you smile on a poor, hapless fellow who loves you more than anything in the world and cannot possibly live without you in spite of his cantankerous father?" "Didn't you forget something?" she said, laughing. "Oh, sorry. In short, will you marry me?" "Yes, I will marry you," she said, "with all my heart. Not half of it, all of it. So it seems we are in agreement. Now all we have to do is convince our parents." John stood up and looked into her intelligent brown eyes. The two of them were conveniently hidden behind the barn. He took her in his arms and kissed her, a kiss that started primly but became increasingly impassioned in the warm summer sun, until interrupted by the approach of a large white horse carrying a well-dressed rider. "That looks like Mr. Vedder," John said. "I wonder what the hurry is." "Do you think something happened?" she said. "I don't know," John said, suddenly having a premonition. "Let's go find out." "You mean both of us?" she said. "I couldn't." "Sure you could. You're practically part of the family now. Besides, are you going to stand here all by yourself until I come back?" "I thought I might go home," she said. "No, come with me," he said. "I have so much more to say to you." She could not resist. They walked around the barn and saw John's father and his friend talking animatedly on the front stoop. "What is it, father?" John said as they approached. Charles turned to him with a beaming face. "They are beaten, my boy, soundly beaten, on Long Island and at Brooklyn Heights. The tall hero Washington and his band of rum-soaked, flea-bitten renegades have been routed by Howe. Isn't it wonderful? And why by Howe? For he is the better man." At these words, Rachel felt a stab in her heart and struggled to keep her feet. "Is Washington taken?" John said. "Unfortunately not," his father replied. "It seems the scoundrel retreated like a beaten dog under the cover of night and managed to get most of his hirelings over to Manhattan. But it's just a matter of time. Howe and his brother have superior soldiers in training and are far better equipped. They will pin them down, and that will be the end of the Great Rebellion. God be praised." "Manhattan, that's not very far away," John said. "No more than 30 miles, said Mr. Vedder. "That's how close we are right now to the famous Continental Army. But don't worry, Washington is no match for Howe. He had some success in the last war, but Howe is a seasoned campaigner and will make short work of the rebels." "Yes, Washington is on the run," Charles said, laughing, "and he will soon run out of places to hide." "But wouldn't he have to march north?" John said. "Ah, my boy, I see your point," his father replied. "They may wind up coming here to White Plains, but Howe will have them directly in hand. How he will do it, we do not know. But the who is himself, and the when is speedily, and the why is because he must." He will indeed, and then these traitors will be dealt with severely, Mr. Vedder agreed, along with all those who support them. This terrified Rachel. Do not forget, sir, she said, shaking, that some friends are likely to be in the way of the oncoming armies. Perhaps we should not wish for too much haste. Mr. Taylor stared at her. I do not wish anyone's friends ill, but I also do not want this foolish conflict to drag on to the detriment of all. Better to be done with it quickly, I say, than to pile on unnecessary years of bloodshed and upheaval. It sounds like your sympathies lie with the rebels, young lady, said Mr. Vedder in an even less amicable tone. I don't think of them as rebels, she said. I think of them as honest men who are standing up for their natural rights of life and property. Ah, so you were an enthusiast of Locke, he replied sardonically, thinking to shut her up. Filmer stirred him up with his Patriarcha, she said, almost babbling, a book my mother despises but my father laughingly likes. But if Filmer is false, it does not follow that everything in Locke must be true. I do agree with the consent of the governed, however, and believe a king's authority to be derived not directly from the divine will, but from the will of those whose lives and well-being have been entrusted to him. For if he treats them well, then the divine will, it seems to me, will have been served. You are a very well-spoken young lady, Mr. Vedder replied, who had only partly followed her reasoning. But I would advise a young girl like you to use caution in the present circumstances. Not everyone will look kindly on sympathy for Washington and his rebellious friends. Don't mind her, Mr. Taylor said. Her father is Ben Allen. Mr. Vedder studied her for a moment with evident dismay. I see the predicament. I speak only in her best interest. There is a time to speak out and a time to be careful about what we say. Rachel longed to point out that they were not being very careful, positively reveling in the defeat of the brave Washington, which she could scarcely believe. She was deeply shaken by the news and its unknown consequences. But for John's sake, she took Mr. Vedder's warning to heart and resisted the temptation to say more. And then she felt an overwhelming desire to go home and to be in a friendly domain with those who were sympathetic to her distress. She took her leave as soon as she decently could, feeling Mr. Taylor's eyes upon her as she made her feeble excuses. She wanted so much for him to approve of her. Had she ruined everything? John walked with her to the road. Now I know your father hates me, she said. I spoke up when I should have kept quiet. I doubt he hates you, John said. I think he may find it surprising for a girl to have such decided and well-informed opinions, but you did not say anything untoward. Indeed, I thought you showed restraint. Besides, it is impossible to express an opinion these days without offending someone. You probably think I have silly opinions too, she said. Not at all, he replied. I thought your answer about Locke was very good. In fact, it was the first time I think I really understood the consent of the governed. As for myself, I am not quite sure what to think. When I hear your father and brother talk about freedom and natural rights, I almost want to become a patriot myself. I have no love of tyranny or taxes. But when I hear my father talk about the reasonable duties of the British citizen, I find myself inclined to agree with him as well. I'm pulled in both directions. You wouldn't be if you were not trying to accommodate me, she said. Not true, he replied. I am pulled because I have mixed feelings. I find the idea of independence and self-government appealing. The colonies should be capable of governing themselves at this point, after so many years of near independence, and it is probably inevitable, given the license they have enjoyed for so long and their prosperity. But I can also see my father's point of view. It does seem like a perilous enterprise, and they are disproportionately joined. Rachel was too agitated to accept this olive branch. But I hope you don't share your father's joy over the Continentals being routed. Not at all, he said. You forget I was born here. I do not have a natural share in my father's happiness regarding the king's victories. But you don't seem terribly upset about it either, she replied. I can certainly understand why you were upset, he said, with the way they were carrying on. Even I was offended. Believe me, I am not one of these Tories who are longing for war. What I want is for us to be walking in the meadow again and doing what we were doing. Which we won't be doing if the armies really are coming here, as you said they were, she replied. I said it was possible they would come here, he said. If Washington and the Continentals are trapped on Manhattan, then there is only one way he can escape, which is to go north. He won't be able to cross over to New Jersey with the king's warships in the harbor. And what about those who have spoken up in favor of independence and been called traitors by the king, she rejoined. Will they be hauled into court and accused? You heard what they said. Patriots will be dealt with severely. Does that mean my family will be hanged? But what if the shoe were on the other foot, he said? Will the Sons of Liberty hang my family as they have been threatening to do for some years now? It seems to me the Loyalists have at least as much to fear from the two armies coming here as the Patriots. That would only be true if the two sides were equal, she said. But according to your father and his friend, they are not equal. In their minds, the Continentals have no chance in such a fight. To John's way of thinking, the Loyalists were the more beleaguered of the two groups, based on recent history and the harshness of Patriot rhetoric, and he was stung by the insinuation that his father would betray Rachel's family. But his love for her told him to stop expostulating and keep these thoughts to himself. For her part, Rachel could not be calmed. Reason had been unseated by the terrible news about the Continentals and fears for her family, and on top of this, it was a hot, muggy day, and she was not at her best in such pitiless weather. John did not seem to realize how her world had been shaken. She needed him to be her support, or at least to understand what she was suffering, but this he did not seem to be willing or able to do, much to her dismay. A stony silence prevailed as they reached the road. They both felt terribly awkward. She glanced at him and he glanced at her, not at the same time. She wanted him to take her in his arms again and kiss her and hold her tight and chase away all her fears, as well as the tension between them. But he stood there looking glumly at the ground with his hands at his sides. "Well, I guess I really should be going since I made such a big fuss about it," she said at last. "It's too hot for that long walk," he said. "Why don't I hitch up the wagon and drive you?" "And antagonize your father even more," she said. "No, thank you. I will be fine. Besides, I need some time to gather my thoughts before I see my family and share the bad news." John could not think of a reply. This was the first time there had ever been any kind of estrangement between them. He was uncertain of how to act or what to do with himself. Rachel also did not know what to say. The things she wanted to say were all based on the extreme anxiety she felt for her family, which seemed likely to make matters worse. She reached out and almost touched his arm. "Can you come over tomorrow?" "I don't know," he said. "I doubt it. My father wants the firewood done by the end of the week, but I will try to get away." "Please do," she said. "It would mean so much to me." She said goodbye and turned to go. As soon as she did, her eyes filled with stinging tears of multiple origins. She walked some distance and then glanced back. John was still standing alone by the gate. He looked forlorn. She felt like running to him, felt it in her loins. But she needed to get home to her family as quickly as possible with her terrible news.